Okay, let's get started. Do we have any question? If you do not have any questions, then I'm planning to just the main topic today is social networks, which we sort of started last class, and we're going to go through that today. So I sort of considered the various types of networks, and these were like more like the motivating examples, and the applications of network theory, social networks, there's lots and lots of them. Even before web, obviously, we'll see some of these collaborations among, you know, people, actors, scientists, and so on. Internet connectivity, the hyperlink structure, which you are most interested in. And we also looked at, in the examples earlier, the idea of the way people interact with each other. For example, the social interactions, the sexual interactions, and also the way things like cellular networks interact with each other. And in all sorts of things, food webs in ecology, phone call patterns, word co-occurrence in the text, and so on and so forth. So there's like a large amount of naturally occurring phenomena could be analyzed with this. And more close to our home, for the web itself, you can deal with, analyze the page importance, which we'll get to probably next class. And we can look at discovering of communities. We will talk about that too. And then also analyzing trust. These are three very useful things that you can do in terms of the social network of the pages. Okay, but for a minute we'll forget about that very specific set of applications that we are interested in and consider just, let's think of social networks in general. And so the idea is to think of networks as graphs. Okay, so you have people are represented as nodes, and if they have some social relationships, those are represented as edges between the nodes. Okay, and so once you have that, you have basically a network or a graph, and you can potentially do various types of graph theoretic analysis with them. And so the let's see now couple of different variations. I mean, we would not say too much as to how these these entities are the nodes are the entities, like the humans in a social network, and the edges of course are the relations. Now the edges could be for example nominal, that means either the edge is appearing or it doesn't appear at all, or it can be signed, such as it is like a negative versus positive edge. I like and I dislike, I trust and I distrust. So it's like there are different types of edges between entities. And also you can have valued entities in the sense that there is a strength provided for each of the network edges. Okay. Now if you do any of these other ones other than nominal, then that sort of becomes a weighted graph and weighted graph analysis. Unless I tell you otherwise, we will assume for that when I don't say anything that the edges are nominal. Okay, it's just direct relation. Okay, the other issue that you're interested in terms of networks are like the size, which is how many nodes are there in the network, how many connections are there between the edges, between the entities in the network, what is the average degree of the entities, in degree versus out degree. One other thing, of course, is these ties can also be, the relations can also be directional as against non-directional. You know, the way I showed it, it's just a non-directional graph, but you could have a directional graph. And in fact, if you think in terms of something like hyperlink structure, hyperlinks are directed links. Okay, so if you put a link to somebody's page, you put that, they don't know that you put that. Okay, so, and if you have directed links, you can talk about both the in versus out degree. So out degree is how many links are going out of you to other nodes, and in degree is how many links are coming from other nodes to you. And if you have a non-directed graph, then there's just one degree for the entity. Okay. Now, what sort of things can we talk about in terms of graph theoretic ideas which make sense for networks? You can talk about walks, which is basically a sequence of edge traversals to go from one node to another node. You can talk about geodesic distance, which is the shortest distance between any two nodes, and assume nominal edges. So shortest distance between any two nodes in terms of the number of edges connecting them. And then you can also talk about things like, basically you can talk about any of the graph theoretic ideas that you probably already know, such as max flow, how much information can flow from one entity to another entity given the network connection that are available. Okay, and depending on the application, you might be interested in any of these ideas. Now, one thing that is particularly interesting, depending on what the network is actually talking about, you could be interested in just flows between different nodes in the network, or you could be interested in which nodes are more important, which nodes are less important, which nodes are more powerful, which nodes are more prestigious, and so on. Okay, and generally, for social networks in general, we want to talk about who is the most powerful entity in this graph. Okay, there are many ways of describing, measuring this. You know, some ideas are, for example, you could consider the degrees, that is, the in degree and out degree of a node. Okay, nodes which are not connected to anybody potentially are not powerful at all. Okay, because there is no interaction between them and other nodes. And if you're talking about undirected graphs, nodes which have high number of connections with other nodes, basically that means they have a high in degree, I mean high degree in general, they're very good. Okay, and then you can also talk about the notions of, if you have input, you know, in terms of the degree, you can also consider talking about importance being a transitive idea. So if you are, it's not just a question of how many links are coming in, but how many links are coming in from important people. Okay, so you could actually, you know, talk about the notion of importance of the entire network, importance of each node in the entire network is sort of simultaneously assessed, such that, you know, if important node, if you are connected to important nodes, then you are in turn important. Okay. And you know, you'll find that that's the sort of thing that actually we'll do in the context of hyperlink networks. You know, when we talk about page ranks and authority subs and so on. Another type of importance, notion of importance, is closeness centrality. So, what is the one entity in the graph that seems to be closest to all other entities in terms of the average distance from that node to every other node in the graph? Okay, so it's like you talk about the central city in a country because that has the fastest connections to every other city in the country. Okay, whereas, you know, towns or cities which are off in the edges, basically they have fewer connections to some feeder cities from where you have to go somewhere. Okay, so this is a different measure of centrality, measure of importance. This is the notion of centrality, this is the notion of degree, and you need to decide for your application what makes sense. And given one of these, you can potentially compute them. You know, you can talk about how to compute the closeness centrality in terms of distance of one node to all others in the network. You can compute that, it's not that hard. I mean, forget about doing it efficiently for now. Just can you given a graph, can you talk about which node seems to be the central node, in the sense that for each node, if you compute the sum of distances to all other nodes and divide by the number of other nodes, that will give you the average distance. And if you then rank the nodes in terms of the lowest average distance to other nodes, which ones will win? Not surprisingly, you know, centroids will win. Right, centroid is actually defined as the point, if you give a set of points, the centroid is the point that, you know, in on the plane, you know, centroid is a point which has the lowest cumulative distance to everybody else. And similarly, in the networks, you will get the central node. Okay. And then between net centrality is another interesting kind of thing, which is if this node seems to come on the path between any other nodes frequently, it's not in itself like a central thing, but somehow you wind up having to go through this, you know, in going from one node to another node. Okay, so these are sort of mountain passes. Okay, so if you have a mountain pass, irrespective of, and so if you have East Coast, West Coast, and then the mountain pass to the Rockies, then pretty much everything that goes from East Coast to West Coast probably has to go through that pass. Okay, if that doesn't make that particular node the most important node, it may not actually be closeness central, but it is betweenness central, in the sense everything that's going from a node to another node seems to frequently go through this node. Okay, so these are some notions of similarity. Some notions of powers and importance and prestige. And you can also be interested, given a network, you can also be interested in measuring cliques. So cliques are near cliques. And what's a clique? Clique is a subgraph of a graph that's complete. Right? Clique is a subgraph of a graph that's complete. And knowing cliques essentially says that those subnodes are essentially well connected to each other. And that sort of sometimes gives you an idea of, even if they're not full cliques, if they are near cliques, that means they are missing maybe one or two edges, but otherwise they're close to a complete graph. Then it's worth knowing that, because that might be, in a large graph, that might be defining a sub-community which shares a lot of interest. Okay, in the web scenarios. And in fact, there's been a lot of work on the web graph trawling for communities, trawling for cliques, trawling for subgraphs which are closely, densely connected, and finding why are they connected. And then notice that in the web graph you only have links, you don't necessarily have the meaning as to why these guys are talking to each other so much, why are these pages talking to each other. Having found a community, oftentimes you can then figure out what that community stands for. Okay, there's been interesting work where sometimes they have found communities that correspond to obvious communities, and sometimes they found communities that they didn't know would be closely connected communities, and because they are interested in some esoteric subject, because of which they will wind up being a clique. And having found this, you now know that that's the reason why they're connected. And of course, Department of Defense is extremely interested in this sort of analysis, because again, once terrorists put up, web pages, they will also connect to each other and make a clique, and then all we need to do is find their clique. Okay, so there's a lot of interest in this kind of link mining, for probably wrong reasons, but that's another important thing. So those are some of the things that you would like to measure on the networks. What we'll do now is actually consider one aspect of the networks that sort of catches people's imagination, which is small world phenomena, which unfortunately is not directly useful, not very directly useful for web, but it's worth understanding anyway. It's kind of a neat idea. So this is probably what you probably heard of when you heard of social networks in general. So the idea is how few edges seem to be needed to go from any node to any other node in a social network. Okay, this is just surprising for most people. And so this is actually just a simple example. I took these slides from Kentaro Toyama, who is now off in Bangalore, Microsoft Research Bangalore. He was a student working in computer vision in Yale University, and then he was working for a while in Microsoft Research in Seattle, Bellevue area. And then when their whole group sort of shifted to Bangalore, he went away to Bangalore. And his argument, in the example here, he was saying he's going to some party and he has to, because he knows this guy and they're going to this party. And he thought, I don't know anybody else who knows Ranjit. And he suddenly finds that, there is some other guy who is common between this guy and him. He's off in India. This guy is a Japanese-American, as you can probably tell from the name. And he suddenly finds a link, and so suddenly you have something to talk about. You feel it's a short, small network, and so he's happy. And then what's more interesting is that if you look at the number of people he knows, you know, which are his, you know, his immediate people, and you look at the number of people they know, he has a pretty darn big network, including, for example, this is the Prime Minister of India, who still is the Prime Minister of India after 2 years, and this is the President of India, and you notice that this guy can come here. So there is like a link to the President of India, another link to the Prime Minister of India. So suddenly you feel good, okay, to the extent no is bi-directional, this is great. But unfortunately, no is not bi-directional, you know. Now what's more interesting, of course, is if I put myself into his social network, I know Drew McDermott, who is a great researcher in automated planning, and he's also done a lot of neat work in AI. And, you know, Kentaro knows him because he went to Yale. I know him because he works in planning. And I know Jhunjhunwala because he taught me communication theory when I was an undergraduate student at IIT Madras. And so I actually did not know that Jhunjhunwala knows Manmohan Singh. So in fact, I know the Prime Minister of India with just one guy. You know, Jhunjhunwala remembers me, and so I can start calling these guys now. So what's interesting, of course, is how small the distances are between, you know, you might think up front that this, you know, you probably would have very few things in common, you know, in a completely new area, and yet, you know, this is a small network. And this is just an example, but the example sort of makes sense here mostly because you have seen this happen in your own life. Okay. In fact, I also know Balki, that's a different story. Now, there is actually, so this is Kevin Bacon game, most of you are familiar with it, which is essentially trying to figure out, given any Hollywood actor trying to find, any actor for that matter, trying to find a sequence of movies such that actor one acted in this movie with actor two acted in this movie with actor three, etc., actor N acted in this movie with Kevin Bacon. Okay, so the adjacency is not no anymore, but have acted in the same movie. Okay, and of course, this is kind of nice because, you know, you can play this game in parties, I guess, at least one time it used to be nice. So you can try to guess how do you connect up any possible actor to Kevin Bacon by listing off a bunch of movies. And, you know, what's interesting, what makes Kevin Bacon game interesting, of course, is if you are trying to remember based on the number of movies that you are aware of, if you can come up with a sequence. Now, Kevin Bacon game, all the fun of it has been ruined completely because there is this oracle of bacon.org where you can write any actor's name and it will give you the shortest distance between that actor and Kevin Bacon. In fact, this is something that you want to keep in mind. Much of the interesting thing about social networks, I mentioned this some number of days back when I first mentioned social networks. Much of the interesting thing about navigation of social networks in your life is because nobody walks around with an entire central database of all their acquaintances. And so there is no single place where you know everybody's acquaintances. So you don't have the network extensionally represented anywhere. What you have instead is you are trying to figure out, you know, locally, you know who you know, and then based on that, you have to ask them who do you know, and then try to find your way through. That's what makes social network navigation in normal life hard. And that's why it's so surprising to you that, wow, you know, I did not have to do that much work. In fact, this whole thing, we'll talk about in a minute, this whole thing came up because of Milgram's experiment, which we'll talk about in a minute, much earlier. Anyway, so this is Oracle of Bacon thing. And what's interesting, of course, is, so here's an example for those of you who don't know. Here is an Indian actor called Amitabh Bachchan, and here is Kevin Bacon, and you want to connect them both. Here is a link. So these two people acted in Mystic River, these two people acted in Code 46, these two people acted in some other movie, and so on, and finally you get to Amitabh Bachchan. Okay. So there are actually four movies connecting, four links connecting Kevin Bacon to Amitabh Bachchan, who is an Indian actor. What's interesting, of course, is so if you are thinking in terms of the distance of Amitabh Bachchan to Kevin Bacon, that's four, because it's four movies away. Okay. What is interesting is if you go to the Oracle of Bacon and ask the same question, it actually says the Bacon number is 3. Amitabh Bachchan's Bacon number is 3 because there is a shorter distance between these two actors, which goes through a different set of movies. And what's interesting is, of course, short can be defined in different ways. What is the shortest distance? You know, you can say shortest distance in terms of just the number of edges, or you can say shortest distance in terms of the weighted sum of the edges. And one of what Cantero probably was doing was to find a path which is more colorful. Okay, you know, he in fact told me when I asked him, after I did this, I had asked him, so why did you not deal with this? And he said he couldn't find a picture of Arne Alpert at all, anywhere, even though this guy is like a big player in many, many movies. So he had to find a longer one which had probably more attractive properties, and he did show that. Okay, now what's more interesting is in the Kevin Bacon universe, if you do some statistics on this, as of some years back, the number of actors in the database for the Oracle of Bacon is 550,000 actors. Okay, so presumably if you throw a stone, you would hit one. And then the average path length to Kevin from any actor is 2.79, assuming just number of edges, not weighted edges, 2.79, which seems pretty darn good. But unfortunately, Kevin Bacon is not the center, so this makes look like he's kind of a central guy, but it turns out in that same network, Rod Steiger is actually more central to the network. The average path length from him to any other actor is 2.53. So Kevin Bacon is not even the central part in Kevin Bacon network, which is kind of interesting to know. So it's just somebody, I don't even know what the heck, why people picked up Kevin Bacon. But clearly he's not. But I'm surprised that Rod Steiger is the central guy in terms of having the lowest number of connections. You know, I don't particularly know what, I don't remember where I saw him, but anyway. So that's the interesting thing. And the rank of Kevin in terms of closeness to the center is 876, which is pretty darn sad. You know, it brings up this whole issue of why is it called Kevin Bacon game? You know, it should be called, it's like this, you know, it's really the life story of this guy. It's Rod Steiger game, but nobody knows anything about Rod Steiger game. Okay. Now, of course, that's for actors, and we are computer scientists. We are not supposed to know any Hollywood movies. So if you are a geek, then you are interested in Erdős number, not Bacon number. Okay. Paul Erdős is a number theorist, and the interesting aspect of him, and in fact, unlike Kevin Bacon, who really does not have any claims to centrality even in Hollywood, Paul Erdős has claims to centrality in mathematics. Why? Because how many of you know Erdős? Okay. Erdős is this Hungarian mathematician who never owned a home, and all his possessions were in little suitcase, and he would just come with that suitcase, drop in any university with his friends, just sit in their home, write a bunch of papers, move on to the next university. So much so that most mathematicians in number theory and central areas of mathematics have written a paper with Erdős. Okay, and who then have written papers with other people. So one can then ask, with paper being the edge, just as movie being the edge in Bacon network, you can ask, what is the collaboration distance? I mean, these are all collaboration distances. So Bacon network is also a collaboration distance. So in the Erdős network, one can ask, what's your collaboration distance to Erdős? Okay, now one can ask also, what's your collaboration distance to Rao? And Rao numbers are much harder to get by because Rao doesn't write papers with too many people. But the issue, one of the interesting things is, he did write enough papers that, you know, he sort of covered a large number of mathematicians. Okay, so people talk about Erdős numbers. So he has written 1,500 papers with about 507 co-authors. Okay, and his co-authors that are like the most prolific co-authors with him are Ron Graham and Fan Cheng. And in fact, Fan Cheng came by, gave a talk here some like last semester, and Ron Graham came by some years back. Anyway, so, and then just as there is an Oracle of Bacon, there is also a database which keeps track of mathematicians' papers with each other, and then it can give you numbers in terms of what's your distance to Erdős. And so if you go to enough professor home pages, you will see people writing Erdős number, my Erdős number is. Okay, and so the idea is, if you, Erdős himself has Erdős number of 0, anybody who wrote a paper with Erdős has Erdős number of 1, and so on and so forth. Okay, again, in fact, unlike Bacon, Kevin Bacon, Erdős does have better centrality in his network, actually. If you look at the entire network, he is in fact quite central to the network. Okay, and what's more interesting is that the connecting path lengths are among mathematicians only is about 4.65 on the average, and the maximum for anybody who is at all connected to Erdős is 13. So after 13 comes infinity. All of you, do any of you have finite Erdős numbers here? Any of you written papers? Writing papers is the first requirement for actually having an Erdős number. Just as I have no Bacon number, I haven't acted in any movies. So if you have an Erdős number at all, that means if you have a finite Erdős number at all, the maximum it can be is 13. After 13 is infinity. You have no path. Okay? Which is kind of interesting. So that's of course the Cantor-Rotayama's Erdős number. That's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So Cantaro is 5, Erdős number. And I have actually a better Erdős number. I only have 4 apparently. I didn't know this. Thankfully, there is MathSciNet. If you go there, you can plug in your name and they will tell you what your Erdős number. In fact, MathSciNet allows you to provide 2 names and it will give you the shortest distance between them. Okay. So since we are really computer science people, we should be interested in the Turing number, not the Erdős number. And I have a Turing number of 7, okay, apparently according to this. And in my little network, it looks like this guy, Dana Now, shows up every time. Here he is on my link to Erdős, and is also in my link to Turing. Okay. And let's see, what else is this? I don't know what else. These are 2 very specific social networks. One is movie actor social network, another is collaboration social network. And one of the interesting things is the maximum distances are not particularly high. Okay? And the average distances are particularly low, given the number of actors involved. Okay, if you have 550 actors, what is the maximum distance you could assume? If the worst case social network, what would be the maximum distance? 550,000 minus 1. Okay? And similarly, but you are seeing that the numbers are much smaller than that. Okay? So there is something going on here where in the network the length, the shortest path connecting any 2 nodes seems to be small overall. This is not true for all graphs that you would think of. Now, this all came up many years back when this guy, a sociologist called Stanley Milgram, did this an experiment where he gave a bunch of people from Nebraska a bunch of letters, and all of them were supposed to send this letter to a stockbroker in Boston, a specific stockbroker in Boston. These people didn't know who that guy, I mean, personally. They knew the guy, but they knew the address, they knew the name, but they didn't know exactly who, they didn't know him personally. And all you could do is you could give your letter to somebody who could then give that letter to somebody else, and they will finally give it to this stockbroker. And you can only give the letter to people you know, obviously. So the question, of course, is he was trying to figure out how long a path would it be before the letters reach the stockbroker. And he found that on the average, for the letters that did find the target, that means for those letters that actually did reach the stockbroker, they made 6 hops. Okay? And this is where the famous 6 degrees of separation came from. You know, many of you heard of the idea 6 degrees of separation. So the idea that any 2 random people are probably connected at most by 6 people. You know, such that you know the first guy, the first guy knows the second guy, and the sixth guy knows the last guy. Okay? And then there was a play and all this, and it became part of the popular vocabulary. And we are basically seeing variations of that. We are basically seeing variations of that in the context of the Bacon world and the Erdős world. It's the same notion of 6 degrees of separation. Okay. There are interesting points to be made here. It turns out that Milgram's experiment was bogus. It was fake. You know, there are all sorts of reasons why he actually did not do the experiment right. He wound up picking people who are also in stock market. So they have a pretty high chance that they know the last guy. So stock market people tend to know more stock market people. So it's not any two random people. Furthermore, he took only the average over the successful letters. And less than 20% of the letters actually reached the final destination. Okay, so it's statistically insignificant thing. But it caught people's imagination. And it so happens that it turns out that even though his experiment is fake, the phenomenon is actually is an explainable and understandable phenomenon. In social networks, in fact, distances are small. Okay, so despite this guy's network, you know, now much later we know that Milgram's experiment has all sorts of problems, but the point he did make, he was trying to make, was correct. Okay, so the question then is can we explain mathematically that this notion of small world phenomena, that means 6 degrees of separation, is just a very specific name for this notion of small world phenomena. That means two random people meet and suddenly talk to each other and find that, you know, they know somebody who knows the last guy and say, oh, it's a small world after all. You know, so we seem to know each other even though we thought we didn't know each other. Okay. So the question is, does the small world phenomena have obvious mathematical backing? Just as I said last class, is there a way of explaining the fact that in any room more than about 20 people, there's always a pair of people, with a very high chance, there's always a pair of people who share a birthday. That means both of them were born on the same day. Now this can be actually shown. And you know that if it's more than 365 people, it's definite. Okay? But even with 20 plus, you start having 0.999 probability. And this can just be shown from elementary probability theory. You are surprised because somehow your intuition thing makes you think that, oh my God, what is the chance? But really there are many pairs in a 20 people room. And the possibility that none of them share a birthday is much lower as the number of people increases. And so around 20, it's totally becoming 0.999. Okay. So my question is, can we do small world phenomena, an explanation for small world phenomena, which is sort of similar to the explanation for birthday paradox, okay, which is no longer a paradox once you understand why the probabilities work out. Okay, so let's look at that, and it's kind of useful because it gives you some idea of how random graphs are. So the idea would be to let's start talking about random graphs, because you know, and then try to analyze random graphs and see what are the connectivity characteristics in random graphs. Okay, so what's a random graph? In fact, when I say random graph, normally when people say random graph, the biggest question, and this is like very important, random anything, okay? Most people think, oh, it's random. So no more is required. I mean, it's random. It's not deterministic, okay? But you have to realize, having taken all your probability statistics courses, that there are randoms and there are randoms. Okay, a random graph with normal distribution is very different from a random graph with a geometric distribution, which is very different from a random graph with uniform distribution. Okay, normally when people say random and not say anything, at least theoreticians, they mean uniform random. Okay. So what we are going to look at when we look at random graphs is uniform random graphs. Okay, where some characteristic is being varied uniformly. Okay. So the idea is, in this case, suppose you have n nodes, then there is a single probability parameter p such that given any pair of nodes, given any pair of nodes, the probability that that pair of nodes will have an edge is the same. It's the same probability p. Okay. Now the p here would be the you know, you can simulate this by basically picking a pair of nodes, and for any p you can get a coin which is weighted such that with probability p it comes heads and 1 minus p it comes tails. Okay, and you toss it, and if it comes heads you put a link, otherwise you won't. That's the randomness. But it's uniform random because for any random pair of any pair of nodes, the probability that they have a link is the same. It's not different. Okay. Now, if you do that, then here are, and now that's, so the all you care about is this n is the size of the network. Now, this is p equal to 0.0, which is, you know, probability 0. That essentially means no pair of nodes have any links. So that graph will look like this. And here p is 0.09, and here p is 1.0. Now p 1.0 obviously is the other extreme, which basically means that you have a complete graph. Everything is connected to everything. Okay. Now probability is what you would use to generate the network, but having generated the network, how does the probability parameter get seen in the network? It gets seen in terms of, so for example, how do I look at this network and see it must have been probability zero? One easy thing to do is think of the degree of the nodes. The degree, you know, if it's an undirected graph, the degree is the number of edges incident on any edge, any node. How many are there? Zero. So clearly the degree is zero in this case. The degree here, it's a complete graph, it's basically connected to all the other nodes in the graph. Okay. So one idea would be to think in terms of this parameter called average degree. The parameter called average degree, where average degree is the probability p times the number of nodes n. That would be the average degree. Okay, because for each node, the number of nodes it will have an edge with is, you know, you're making the pair by taking this constant and picking every one of the n minus 1 nodes. For each one of them, that the fact that it will have an edge is probability p. And each of them are independent. Okay? So the number of edges would be p times n. P times n minus 1, which is approximately p times n. So let's look at this average degree of the graph, which is connected directly to the probability that any pair of nodes will be connected. Okay? Now the question would be, what interesting things can we say about the different values of p as n is held constant? Okay. What? It should be what? What should it be? It would. There seems to be a mistake here. Each of them are connected to n minus 1 nodes. Yeah, it should not be half n squared. Okay. So what we would look at, yeah, there seems to be an error there. I should check out that. What we should look at now is, given these four graphs, and these are for the different, so I actually add an extra graph. This is 0.05, and this is 0.09, and this is 1.0, that's 0.0. And the k values here is 0, 0.5, 1, and more than 1. Okay. What would I be interested in looking at? What I would be interested in looking at are, the following things. Unfortunately, you can't see much here. Size of the largest connected cluster. So given the graph, what is the size of the largest connected cluster such that every node is connected? It's not a clique, not largest clique, but largest connected cluster. Okay, so for example, for this graph, what is the size of the largest connected cluster? One. Okay, what about this? One, two, three, four, five. That's the five here, okay, and so on. And of course, the size of the largest connected cluster here is n. because that's a complete graph. Okay, that's one other thing. So the next one is the diameter of the network, which is the longest connected path in the graph. So if two nodes are connected at all, then what is the longest path? So this diameter is what we were talking about in the Kevin Bacon game and Erdős game, because you know, if you never wrote a paper, then your Erdős number is infinity. When we said the maximum seems to be 13, we only care about people who do have a finite number. So it's a part of the, if in the graph that is connected, what is the longest walk you can do, essentially? That's what we are talking about. Okay? And what's the diameter for this? Zero. What's the diameter for this? One. What about the diameters for these guys? It can be quite high. In the middle, it can actually be a chain graph. Depending on the way the random things worked out, it could be a chain graph. So diameter could be as high as n minus 1. You see that? So the harder graphs in terms of traversal live in the middle with respect to this probability p and the k. Okay? Where k, of course, is defined in terms of p and n. And then the final thing, of course, is average path length between nodes, which is sort of related to the diameter. The larger the diameter, the larger the average length is going to be. Okay? Those are the things we want to see. And if you look at it in this particular case, you know, for these things, you can actually write down all of those numbers because they're exact graphs there. Okay? And as expected, they are higher in the middle. The diameters and the average distances are higher in the middle and smaller on the ends. Okay? And then connected component becomes very high here and very small here, and somewhere in the middle they start becoming bigger and bigger. Yes?
But then if this kind of analysis is acceptable, I mean a random graph analysis is acceptable, and you told you what Milgram did also, like, because the last point, we are only considering connected nodes when we are taking the average path length.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what Milgram did. He didn't consider the ones who weren't connected in a way.
Yes, actually that's a reasonable point. The bigger issue with Milgram's experiment is, we'll see, so that's why it's not enough to just talk about the diameter without talking about the connected component size. What's interesting here is the largest connected component here is 11, and there are only 12 nodes. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I'm not just saying that the average distance and the maximum distance is 7 and 4.2, I'm also saying this tells you how much of the graph is connected. So by here, in fact, if you look at both in conjunction, you can make better claims as to whether are you just talking about the diameter over just a very small part of the graph, or if the component, largest component, is almost equal to the size of the graph, then you must be talking about the entire graph. And what's interesting is that it became close to the size of the graph at k equal to 1. Okay, whereas k can, and which is probability is 0.09, and it can go much higher. Okay, so here is what actually you can show analytically. I mean, those are just examples. For probability, for uniform random graph, you can analytically show the following thing. If k is less than 1, which is k is the average degree, which is equal to probability p times the n, which is the number of nodes. If k is less than 1, then you have small isolated clusters. That means the connected graph pieces are small on the whole. Small diameters within each of those clusters. Small diameters within each of those clusters, and so short path length within each of those clusters. But there are too many clusters, so it's more like the Milgram experiment. If k equal to 1, around k equal to 1, a giant component emerges. It's going to be almost the size of the number of nodes in the network. Around k equal to 1, everything is almost connected to everything else. Connected, not click, but connected. Okay? And diameter peaks here. Despite the fact that, so that's the interesting thing. Here, very few things are connected, but the diameter is small. Here, everything is connected, but the diameter becomes larger. So the traversable distance has become longer. Okay? And path lengths are also high, because diameter is high. And when k is greater than 1, on the other hand, you would assume, I mean, these extremes you can understand, this extreme you can understand, you should be able to understand this extreme too. When the degree is very high, it must be the case that any pair of nodes are connected, right? And so basically the entire graph is a whole big component. It's a complete graph, so it's a component. Okay, and then the diameter is going to be just one edge because everybody is connected to everybody, and so is the average instance. What's interesting is we all know that we expect that this is correct in this level, it's correct in this level. Okay, so if I were to talk about the diameter, it starts small and becomes small again. Okay, so I know that it will be sort of like this, I mean it will be low here, it will be low here. The question is, how does the actual behavior look like? So there are many graphs which are sort of, so if you are talking about k, okay, I know that for k equal to small, the diameter should be low. I know that for k equal to large, diameter should be low. That's all I know. But, you know, that is true of this, that's true of this, that's true of this, that's true of this. There's no reason to believe that the world is more like this than like this, really. Okay, and yet what we are actually seeing, I mean, what that graph is showing, and you can actually show that this is the case in, you know, by just analytically, that there is a sharp threshold around 1.0, diameter peaks very rapidly, just around 1.0 in a short narrow region. Okay? And it falls down, right exactly at 1. And you call that kind of sharp threshold phenomena phase transition. Okay? And phase transitions, you knew about phase transitions before, but mostly for physical systems. Right, if you boil water, slowly water tries to become vapor. At every temperature it's trying to become vapor. Okay, as you increase the temperature, you expect it to become more and more of the water will be trying to become vapor. What's interesting about the way water tries to become vapor is at 100 degrees centigrade, everybody at once wants to become vapor. It's not that let's wait for 101 more people get to go. 100 is a sharp threshold. At 100 degrees centigrade, all of water molecules want to become vapor, I mean steam. That's why it's a phase transition. Because there's a sharp point where the phase transition occurs. And when that occurs, it's interesting phenomenon. It's not just slowly, you know, water is becoming steam through evaporation pretty much at every temperature. At 100 degrees centigrade, all hell breaks loose and everybody wants to become vapor. Okay, the same thing when in the other phase transition. At the 0 degrees centigrade, all water molecules want to become ice. Okay, now we are now seeing computational phenomenon where with respect to some critical parameter, such as in this case, the degree, suddenly you have a phase transition. It turns out that these sort of things are pretty common in computational problems. This is the one you will see in this class. For example, if you talk about the difficulty of finding a Hamiltonian circuit, if it exists, in a graph, and you plot that with respect to the degree of the graph. Okay? Clearly, low degree graphs, Hamiltonian circuit, zero chance of having it. High degree graphs, Hamiltonian circuit, very high chance of having it. What's more interesting, low degree graphs, you can prove that you don't have a Hamiltonian circuit very quickly by failing. Because here is a node, nobody is connected to it. What hope is there that you'll have a Hamiltonian circuit? How many of you know what a Hamiltonian circuit is? Hamiltonian circuit in a graph is a walk which connects every node in the graph. So it's a sequence, it's a circle of edges which goes from one node to another node to another node, another node, another node, comes back to the old node without ever crossing, without ever reaching a node more than one. Okay, it's well known that Hamiltonian circuit finding is an NP complete problem. But what is interesting is that just because it's NP complete problem, you should realize what NP completeness means. NP completeness means if I have a huge big bag of problems, one problem in that whole bag is exponentially hard. then you say this whole bag is exponentially hard. NP completeness is about worst case complexity of the hardest instance. This bag could be full of easy to solve problems except one bad seed, and it will still be considered NP complete. Okay, so Hamiltonian circuit is NP complete, but it turns out that in fact for most normal graphs you would find Hamiltonian circuit, if you consider in terms of degree, you would find that, you know, for the low degree there is no, the probability that there is a Hamiltonian circuit is zero. Okay, so let's look at two different things. One is the probability, the other is the time taken to prove, I mean time taken to exhibit the circuit by actually going through the entire graph. Okay, for the low degree the probability will be close to zero, for high degree the probability will be close to one. Somewhere between here and here you would think slowly it increases. That's what you would think, just like here. Somewhere between here and here it will go up and come down. Now, so this is increasing, one question. The other question is, if I have my another color somewhere. Okay. Doesn't like it. Okay, there's a pen there. So that's the probability. The green is the probability. Okay? Probability that a random graph with low degree, with a degree of that size, average degree of that size, has a Hamiltonian circuit at all, is zero here, is one there. Now what is the difficulty, the time you spend in answering Hamiltonian circuit or showing that there is no Hamiltonian circuit? How do you think that computation will go? I would say that time taken to prove that there is no Hamiltonian circuit here will be low. It's low because you can easily show that there are pieces of the graph which are unconnected from everybody else, you're done. On this side, again, it will be low. Right? And how about in the middle? In the middle, you can't be sure. You have to really look at the entire graph to see maybe there is a way of actually finding a path through all the nodes which don't cross over each other. So you would expect that this sort of goes like that. What is mind-boggling is that with respect to degree, it goes like that, the complexity. And the probability goes exactly, and the same way the probability goes exactly like this. That's the phase transition. And you're seeing the exact graph here, except I changed the names now. I'm calling this the diameter. I'm calling this the, what is this? What are we calling this? One is the diameter, the other is the probability. The percentage of the nodes in the largest component. That's what we're talking about here. This is the percentage of nodes in the largest component. By the time it comes here, it will be 100% of nodes. Here, it will be 0% of nodes because, you know, each node is its own cluster. You would think it slowly increases to one, but it actually kind of sharply goes. Okay, there are lots and lots of interesting phase transition phenomena. This is for Hamiltonian circuit. If you know SAT problems, satisfiability problems, they have a phase transition phenomena. For random 3-SAT problems are extremely easy to solve, except in a very narrow band where the number of clauses to variables is the magic number 4.3 something. Okay. Now, where there are phase transitions, it's interesting to know that, because if I told you Hamiltonian circuit problems are hard, they're NP complete, you went home and you generated random graphs, just uniform random graphs. And you found how much time are you taking. And you're finding that most of the time it will take very little time. Right? Because that's exactly what that is showing. In most graphs of the world, either exhibiting the Hamiltonian circuit or proving that it doesn't exist is extremely easy. So you would be thinking, hey, you know, you told me that it can be complete, and yet in practice I'm doing extremely well. It's like sublinear performance. What good is it? Now, once you realize that this is the way the problem is, then this is where the hard problems live. So you could generate graphs which are around that degree. I don't remember the exact transition degree for the Hamiltonian circuit. You could still generate random graphs which have average of that degree. Okay? And then try to solve them. That's when you are solving the hard problems. You need to know where the hard problems live before you say my algorithm solves them all easily. Okay, so it's a much more subtle point that we're making here. And it so happens that it's connected for our social networks too. At 1.0 effective degree, which corresponds to a probability, so effective degree 1.0, and that is equal to k equal to p times n, right? So p is 1 by n. If the probability that any pair of nodes are connected is equal to 1 over n, where n is the number of nodes, and if you generate the graph that way, that is your death knell. That's where diameters peak. Okay? Now, if you look at this graph, I argue that it should completely explain why small world phenomena exist in real world. If to the extent these random graphs are sort of representative of social networks, which is a big if, then I would argue that this graph is explaining to you why small world phenomena exist. Because if the diameter is small, it's small world, right? The diameter is small, it's small world. So either you have to argue that most real world is this side, or most real world is this side. You just have to avoid being here. Then you're okay. What do you think real world social networks are? Which side of this graph are the real world social networks? What? Right side. Greater than 1.0. Because most people have at least more than 1%. I mean, there are, in social networks do not have degree 1. They have oftentimes much greater than degree 1. All you need to know is whether it is greater than degree 1 at all, because right after 1 it becomes easy. Okay, so this is a kind of a circuitous way of proving, essentially, by touching the phase transition, etc. In fact, we don't even care about the phase transition region. All we care about is phase transition exists at 1.0, and you then say, look, k is the effective degree, which is the average degree. Now, in most social networks, human social networks, average degree is greater than 1, significantly greater than 1. All it needs to be is like 0.001 greater than 1, and it will be easy. And it will be much more than 0.001 greater. It's more like 2, 3, 4. So it's easy. So we have essentially shown that small world phenomena are like birthday paradoxes. They are completely explainable from the elementary laws of probability. Okay? Yes. No, so if here, that means nobody is connected to anybody. So clearly there is no circuit. Here everybody is connected to everybody. So there is a circuit. So what a Hamiltonian circuit says is, there is a circuit in the graph that you can show. It's not that there are no edges other than the circuit. There can be many, many edges. But there is a tool which touches every one of the nodes in the graph without touching any one more than one. That's what a Hamiltonian circuit is. Okay, so this is first of all the first thing you should understand. Random graphs have these nice properties. You should not be surprised at small world phenomena. Okay? In fact, not surprisingly, Paul Erdős, the guy who we were talking about, and Rennie in 1959 actually did this analysis on random graphs. And even provided whatever I said is basically Erdős analysis. And what they showed essentially, and it's not that hard to follow the reasoning, that for any random graph of effective degree k and size n, the average path length between connected nodes is ln n by ln k. Okay, so they have nice analytical expressions and everything. And since in the average person easily knows more than one person, we do live in a small world. And you should not be surprised. Okay, if you are in a more of a, you know, marginally socially challenged world, where, you know, if it is completely socially challenged world where nobody talks to anybody, it's easy again. It's this marginally socially challenged world where you may have on the average of one or less number of people you know. That's when you have trouble. Okay? Thankfully, you know, most social networks don't have this problem. Okay. So, there is, in this big statement, it says, if connections between people can be modeled as a random graph, then. Okay, that's a big if. Okay, so is it really the case that given you and any other random person in the world, you have the same probability of knowing that person, which is, let's say, P equal to 0.03, that means you and every random person in the world, there's only 0.03 probability of knowing that person. That's not true. Actually, you tend to know many more of the people in computer science. You tend to know many more of the people who are in your neighborhood. So real world graphs are random, but they are not uniformly random. They are biased random. Anything other than uniform random is biased random. Normal curve is a biased random process. It has a mode, something which is much more likely. Okay? Uniform random has no mode. Everybody is equally, every pair is equally, has an equal chance of being connected to each other. Yes?
But it's easier to fix that. If you fix your word, then you can make it uniformly random again. Because if you fix your word, then you know the...
It's not clear. It's still not clear. Is it really true that in computer science, the probability that you know somebody for any pair of nodes, the probability that those pair of nodes know each other is equal? No, you could be the geek in the class who nobody wants to talk to, or you may be the most popular guy in the class and everybody wants to talk to you. Irrespective of the size of the world, in fact, the graphs, real world graphs, have this property that popular people get more popular. Okay, so if you go into a new classroom, and you haven't been doing this often nowadays, but you know, when you were in high school or junior high school or, you know, elementary school, the reason popularity is interesting is because the new kids just automatically gravitate towards the kids who seem to be part of a big group. So popular kids become more popular. Okay? It's not really the case that when a new kid comes, he or she looks at the entire class, yeah, the probability that I'll talk to this guy is the same probability P as the probability that I'll talk to this guy who seems to be in the middle of a group making a major lecture and seems to be the most popular kid in the class. It's not the case. We actually do have biased probabilities. Okay. All I'm saying is, I'm not saying that the graph is not random. Graph is not deterministic. But it's biased random. It's not uniform random. And pretty much only one distribution in the world is uniform random. That's uniform distribution. Everything else is still probabilistic distribution, but it is biased. It has more. It has multiple modes sometimes. Bimodal, trimodal distribution, so on. Okay, so the question is, we agree that the real world is not actually a random graph. The question is, what sort of random, so they're not random graphs in the sense they're not uniform random graphs. So if you are looking to model real world graphs, what would be the best way to model it? That brings us to something very deep, a second deep thing, which actually is this idea of scale-free networks or power law networks. Okay, so a random network, essentially, as I said, the probability that any pair of nodes are connected is exactly the same, irrespective of the pair. A power law network looks more like this. It's also a random network, but it tends to have hubs. There are islands of popularity. Some nodes seem to be more popular. They have much higher degree. Okay. Now the difference between these and these is you cannot say that there is anybody who is like significantly more popular than anybody else in this graph. Whereas in the power law networks, the kind of things that you have seen in the real world, where you went to junior high, etc., there are popular kids. And the difference between the number of people the popular kids know and the number of kids any other person in the class knows is huge. And so there are hubs. Okay, it's a biased distribution of degree. Okay, so this is more like the networks that you see. And how about web? There are some nodes which seem to have a lot more in degree and lot more out degree than some other, most other nodes. There are hub nodes like Yahoo, which have huge number of links going out of them. Yahoo directory, for example. Okay, there are authority nodes like ACM or some other, you know, bigcompany.com, which seems to have many degree, many nodes, many links coming in. And then you are you and me. I'm better than you, but you know, we're all still losers compared to Google.com and Yahoo.com. Okay? That's how real networks are, and that's not modeled by the uniform random networks. So you need to model it using biased random networks. So now, all I said is, you know, it's not enough to just say that it's not uniform random. I need to give you some family of distributions that seem to capture the biased randomness that exists. So since I've been talking about the degrees, let's look at the degree distributions. The degree distributions in a random graph versus the kind of graph that seems to occur in the real world. Okay? In a uniform random graph, the degree distribution would be like this. Just because it's random doesn't mean that everybody has the same degree. Remember, randomness is at the lowest level. When you're picking a pair of nodes, you are using the same probability parameter P to decide whether they will have a link or not. But in doing so, you will still get nodes which have higher degrees than other nodes. This is the bell curve. This is actually the Poisson. This is called the Poisson distribution. It's sort of the closest you can get to normal distribution in the context of discrete variables. This is the kind of curve you have seen. All your life you depended upon people doing well or not well in the class, you know, according to the normal distribution, so that the ABCDs can be given with respect to that. Okay. Here is, if you, so basically this curve is basically showing the different degrees and the probability or the fraction of nodes having that degree. And all this thing is showing is around 15 is the mean. That means that's the mode. More than mean, I want to talk about mode. 15 is the mode degree. That means most nodes seem to have about 15 connections. And there are very few guys who seem to have connections greater than 30. Really, really few guys who are, I mean, similarly very few guys who have connections less than 5. Do you remember how the normal distribution falls away from the mean? How many of you remember normal distribution at all? How does it fall? It falls exponentially. It falls exponentially. So in fact, for all practical purposes, all you need to remember about this is just that. This is why Six Sigma kids are interesting. You heard about the word Six Sigma kid? Six Sigma kid is the kid in the class who really is a problem kid. He or she does 6 times better than the mean, six standard deviations better than the mean, or 6 standard deviations worse than the mean. One case, it's a problem for the teacher. The other case, it's a problem for the rest of the class. Either way, Six Sigma kids, you know, natural selection makes sure that they don't survive. That's a different story. But it's interesting because it's very hard to find things away from the mean. But at the same time, it's also interesting that when you see the bell curve, the most popular degree is 15. If you take 14, it's still pretty darn close to being popular. There are almost as many nodes of degree 14 as there are nodes of degree 15. It's only when you come here, it becomes zero. Keep that in mind. This is how the degree distribution looks for the kind of graphs you see in the real world. Okay? And this is a classic power law distribution. Oftentimes, you see this as some k power minus r, where r is the exponent. Okay? There are two things. Everybody, I mean, one of the interesting things about this kind of thing is people tend to focus on the wrong part of the power law distribution. Everybody realizes this peak. My God, the guy who has the most popular degree is much more popular than the second most popular degree. Okay, so the peakedness of this one basically, it's like the peak is really sharp. So in all power law distributions, the most popular kid has a lot more friends than the second most popular kid. People don't even know who the second most popular kid is most of the time. That's why it's very important to be first. In fact, one of the cardinal rules of marketing is you create a category where you are number one, because nobody remembers number two. There's a beautiful story about this. Who is the guy who crossed Atlantic solo, flying? Who is the person who crossed Atlantic solo second? Who is the person who crossed Atlantic solo the third? You would think, if I don't know who the guy who crossed second, you probably don't know who is the person who crossed third. But you know. She is in a different category. Who crossed Atlantic first? Among women, Amelia Earhart. So Amelia Earhart is remembered because she has her own category. She's number one in her category. Being number two, I mean, being above her in the category of all humans doesn't help. So in fact, the marketing always tells you that if you can't be first, in fact, the classic rule is it better to be first than to be better. You know, you just go first to the market. You know, being better is not as important. And partly because of this kind of phenomena. The first person has much higher popularity than the second most popular person. This is clear. There is this difference between this and this. What people miss is there is this difference here too. So there is the sharp drop at the mode, but there is also never-ending tail. The tail is only falling polynomially, k power minus r. The tail here falls exponentially. R power k is what it's falling as. Here it's k power minus r. Okay? This is what your long tail is. So, even though compared to Yahoo and Google, we are all losers in terms of in degrees, I can still look down on you because in the tail I'm still little less of a loser than some of you are. And then you can then go look down on people who are just starting their pages and say, oh my God, you only have 15 links? I have 17. You know, so there's no end. This thing goes on and on and on. Okay, and how many of you read the long tail of that little thing I read? You guys should read it now. You know, it explains why it makes sense to do niche marketing, because there are infinite number of niches. Whereas if the world is this way, there is no real point because there is no market on this side. You may as well just be concentrating on the mean. So power laws are interesting for two completely different reasons. Everybody thinks about this, which is the sharp fall from in terms of popularity, but this is just as important. This is the heavy tail or the long tail. Okay? And all that it's basically saying is that the distribution is k power minus r. You know, that's the definition of the analytical distribution. Many, many real-world networks exhibit power law distribution. Okay? Web graph exhibits power law. In fact, this R, typically for most real-world graphs, if you fit the data, it'll be R between about 2 and 3. That's so amazing. Okay? And in fact, for web graphs, if you look at the entire web graph and do the power and distribute, if you try to plot the degrees of the web graph and try to fit the R to it, fit a power law curve to it, you would get that R is about 2.1 for the in degree and 2.7 for the out degree. Okay? The last slide before we leave today is this. In fact, the easiest way to fit power laws for any distribution is to plot it in log log plot. Because if y equal to k power minus r, then log of y is equal to minus r times log of k. So if you think of log of k as x and log of y as the y axis, then it's just minus r sloped line. So any distribution which is power law, when you draw it in a log log graph, looks like a straight line. And the slope of the straight line is equal to r. And here are four graphs. This is the degree distribution of hyperlinks on the web graph. The first one. The second one is the degree distribution of the co-starring in the movies. The third one is the co-authorship of physicists. The fourth one is co-authorship of the neuroscientists. And you can make more and more graphs like this. They're all power laws. So you've seen something completely interesting, which is a different type of random graphs of type k power minus r, where r is the important factor, but they all have, r is normally between 2 and 3, but anything r greater than 1, greater than or equal to 1, it will have the same property. R equal to 1, there is a discontinuum, because in fact when r equal to 1, it becomes a harmonic series, and so the area under the curve diverges. Remember, harmonic series is, you know, harmonic series doesn't have a, you know, it's not a convergent series. But anything greater than 1, it converges. Okay? This has been, and now, okay, I'll end with this, really, okay? Which is, this is a digression, we'll come back to it next class. It turns out that if you consider popularity of words in a language, popularity of words in a language, that also is a power law distribution. So the most popular word in English, not surprisingly, is the. In some reasonably large corpus, it is appearing 7 million times. The second most popular word is of. It's not appearing 7 million minus 5 times. It's appearing 3 million times, close to half less. So in fact, words in languages, especially English language, are observe a power law distribution with r equal to close to 1. And this is called the Zipf's law, because Zipf found this out. Okay? And then this has a consequence that if Zipf's law is holding, then as the size of the corpus increases, the vocabulary increases square root or some negative power. So vocabulary increases much slower because there are more popular and less popular words. I'll end with this, and you go and think about this. If you have this one more, that's the second one is called the Heap's law. There's a Zipf's law, there's a power law, there's a Heap's law, there's a Zipf's law, and this is the Benford's law, which is if you have a bunch of numbers describing some natural phenomena, let's say the heights of different trees in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, or if you don't like that forest, some other forest, exact sizes of heights of all the trees. So you have a big list of numbers, right? I'm asking the following question. What is the fraction, what if you look at these numbers as digits, what fraction of these digits would be 1? How many digits are there? 1 to 9, right? Okay, so you would think about 11% should be 1. Okay? It turns out, mind-blowingly enough, that 1s are 30%, 2s are 17%, 3s are 12%, and so on. And this holds whether it is tree height or whether it is the height, you know, length of your hair, most naturally occurring phenomena. Okay? And it's so much so that if people actually make up, suppose you don't feel like counting all the lengths of all the trees, you know, your boss said, you know, here, I'll give you some money, go measure all the trees and then write their heights. And you made up the height, you're more likely than not to put 11% of each digit for every thing. And that way I can show that you're wrong. So at least if you want to cheat your boss, you need to know Benford's law, because most naturally occurring ones do not go 11%. Okay? We'll talk about all these power law distributions and their connection to social networks and stuff.